Good jobs, quality jobs.
We still have so much to do for women's rights.
For the parents to go to work, you need good childcare.
We will not have a successful recovery if we leave social rights.
Reinventing our way of building and living.
It is our right.
Hello everyone and welcome to this edition of Eurofound Talks. Today Eurofound Talks minimum wage. As the EU economy advanced in its recovery following the pandemic, the high rate of inflation throughout 2022 and 2023 due to the other external factors such as Russia's aggression in Ukraine meant that the wage setting actors made their decisions under a cloud largely of uncertainty and insecurity. So while nominal increases in minimum wages did reach an all-time high, the impacts of these policies in the pockets of workers and the general public on the streets throughout Europe have been very much more complicated. At the same time, the EU sought to improve the situation of low-wage earners through its directive on adequate minimum wages. And this is what we're going to talk about today, trying to look at the impact of the minimum wages at this time in our development in society and with all of the different drivers at play, but also looking at the compliance of minimum wage and how that's playing out. And we're very fortunate to have with us experts in this area where Eurofound has done an awful lot of research over many years. One of them is Christine Omeyer-Pintar. Welcome, Christine. And Carlos Vaca-Soriano, who is also an expert in this area. So welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
So today we're going to start, Christine, like we usually do, really just setting the scene and getting a broad picture of what we're talking about. So if we're looking at minimum wages coverage in Europe, how many member states actually are covered by a national minimum wage? And I suppose what proportion of the working population in Europe earns in and around that minimum wage? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thank you, Mary. So this year, for the first time, we can say that 22 out of 27 member states are covered by national minimum wage because as of 1st January 2023, Cyprus has joined the club of having introduced a universally covering statutory minimum wage. And if you ask about which percentage of the workforce is covered, I think we could do a whole full day filling technical podcast about that with Carlos, explaining why it is so difficult to measure that. But according to our latest data that we have, which is based on 2019 incomes, we estimate that around 4% of the working population in the EU earn around the minimum wage.
Okay, and just to be clear on that, that means that, so 22 out of 27 are covered, that means five not covered. What about them?
Yeah, so not covered by a national universal rate, but in those remaining member states, we have collectively agreed minima and at the sectoral level. So that's Austria, Sweden, Italy, Denmark, and Finland. And they continue to have the minimum pay for workers set in very widely covering sector-related collective agreements.
And having some kind of minimum wage requirement is a requirement.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. And in terms of what I talked about earlier, the minimum wages and how they changed in 2023, what were the main driving forces behind this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we have two main drivers, mm-hmm. I would say. So the first one you already mentioned in your introduction, it's clearly the high level of inflation that we saw. Consumer prices went up, and also in many countries last year, minimum wage setters did take this into account, albeit not, everywhere to the extent that workers really saw the value or purchasing power of their minimum wages preserved. On the other hand, the second main driver for larger increases was certainly the minimum wage directive. I mean, this has a pull factor on minimum wages, and it will increase further as we go along. When I say that, I mean, I'm now referring and looking back to what has happened until the 1st January 2023, because this is as far as our latest report covers the data. And, you know, at the time when we gathered the data, that was around the same time last year, we found that quite often the increases that we saw, they were not really large enough to keep pace with inflation. So we had about a third of the member states where workers lost purchasing power, the real value of their wages, because the increases were not keeping up with inflation. We had another third of countries that kept it stable, and we had a third of countries where there was a positive increase. And now as we're sitting here at this time of the year, so end of the year, December, it's another very exciting moment because this is really the time where most member states have already set their national rates for the next year. And some are still, you know, in the process of negotiating, and we will see the outcome very soon. But we have already data now for 24. Mm-hmm. And what we can see now is really that the tides seem to be turning again.
Okay.
Yeah, which is, I would say, relatively good news. And
what does that mean in practice then, Christine?
Yeah, so in practice, we see that for the 14 countries out of the 22 with the national minimum wage, we see that there was actually a real increase again in minimum wages, not only compared to the last year, but also if you look at the time when the inflation started to grow and started mm-hmm. to develop. And this, again, I would relate to both factors. On the one hand, trying to compensate the workers for the loss in purchasing mm-hmm. power via inflation, but also second, as an early effect of the directive. Because okay. the directive is not transposed yet. Member states mm-hmm. have another year to do that. Mm-hmm. So next year we will see, you know, is there a further impact? But I think we can already see a pull effect coming from the directive as well.
Okay, so that's positive news in terms of how that's playing out across these countries. But just to go back to what we talked about, these other five countries where there was a collectively agreed minimum wage, if you like, does that apply to them also in the same way?
Well, I mean, the requirement is there that member states, everyone should make sure that workers are protected by adequate wage floors. But the countries with collectively agreed minima, they have a different set of articles in the directive that will apply to them. So they are not bound by the same set of criteria that the countries with statutory minimum wage have.
And are we seeing the same turning of the tide for those countries as we are for the others?
I cannot say that yet because mm-hmm. we have not started to look into all these collective sure. agreements. So mm-hmm. this is a very tedious job to mm-hmm. do to gather these, you know, bits of information. It's much mm. easier to go for that one rate that exists in a country rather than. But we will do so in the forthcoming report for sure.
Okay, no, because yeah. that is interesting yeah. itself. Yeah.
But what I can say about these countries is that in the last year we did a similar exercise. We looked at say 10 agreements from each of these countries, low paid agreements that we follow over time, and we did see that at the time they did have a lower increase and they were slower to react to the changing environment with the inflation, which is, you know, it's a natural thing mm-hmm. because as a if many actors are negotiating, it takes them longer mm. and it takes them longer to come to an agreement than that one actor that sets the statutory minimum.
So sort of a bottom up is slower than a top down in this case.
Exactly. Or a yeah. fragmented process mm. based on many actors is also mm. slower.
More difficult but, yeah. to come.
But which doesn't mean, you know, yeah. this is not a normative finding. Sure. It's just the way yeah. it is. Overall yeah. collective bargaining can then also.
No, absolutely. No judgment. Yeah. It's just a question of the situation as it stands. But in terms of what you were talking about there, those who lost purchasing power, those who are stable, and of course there were some who have seen an increase. But are the workers actually benefiting from that wage increase that we're seeing, mm. the minimum wage increase?
Well, if you look at the larger increases that will be given for the next mm. year, I'm sure, you know, this is good news for them. And this is certainly better than nothing. Absolutely. And we will obviously always have to look at what it means for the workers in net terms. Mm-hmm. And when I say net terms, we are looking at the moment at gross, the development of gross minimum wages. What you take home depends on the taxation.
several and the other countries, benefits that are available, etc.
Exactly. Several countries have opted not to tax minimum wage workers too strongly. But the question in an inflationary environment is also to what extent do these tax thresholds or social security thresholds shift when you have a nominal increase in your minimum wage. So that we saw also coming up as a topic in several countries that in the context of inflation, countries realized that, okay, we also have to increase the tax threshold under which you do not have to pay such contributions. So that again, you know, that the increase that is given on the gross wage then comes down also to people in their pockets.
And have we done work on that, Christine, that's related to how that sort of threshold changes?
Not systematically, I would say, but we do have examples of such policies in both the minimum wage report, but also in Policy Watch, EU Policy Watch, if you look at our website.
In the database. Policy Watch database was created actually during the COVID-19 pandemic to look at the kind of initiatives and measures that were put in place by social partners and governments to offset the worst effects of the pandemic. And of course, it's been extended now to take on other issues, for example, the cost of living crisis and the impact of the war in Ukraine. But just to come back to this on how effective the minimum wages are, I mean, we see that they're likely, at least, or you're seeing some sign that they are beginning to have an effect on how workers are able to offset the cost of living issues. But in terms of reducing income inequalities, is it too big an ask to think that by raising the minimum wage that we will actually go some way to addressing that?
Yeah, I think this is a very big question because obviously wages are just one part of income, of people's income, and you need to look at other components of income as well if you want to address this question, answer this question. So we have to ask ourselves to what extent do minimum wage changes reduce wage inequalities? And then to what extent do wage inequalities reduce income inequalities? Mm-hmm. For the first question, we know that indeed, minimum wages can reduce wage inequalities, but usually only just up to a certain amount of the wage distribution. So, say it reduces inequality in the bottom half of the wage distribution. Mm-hmm. That's what we find throughout several empirical studies. But then, if you look at the overall wage distribution, obviously the question also depends on what happens to the higher wages. Mm-hmm. So if you have higher wages outpacing the growth of minimum wages, again, you will see increasing wage inequalities, and the minimum wage changes will not have a big impact on how the highest wages develop or not. Yeah. And in terms of income inequalities, I think this is also something where Carlos has done quite a bit of research looking into that question in depth. So the question, are income inequalities actually driven by wage inequalities, or what else is there to influence income inequalities? And Carlos showed that after the Great Recession, the income inequalities were actually much more driven by changes in unemployment. So you had increasing income inequalities simply because people were losing jobs, and many people were losing jobs.
Do you want to add to that, Carlos, in terms of the inequalities?
Yeah. Yes, it's because, for example, in this minimum wage debate, right, like when we think about people that may be getting the minimum wage, like minimum wage earners, I think it's easy to think that if you improve their wage, you're going to improve a lot the economic situation of their household. But the reality in Europe, as Christine said, is that when we look at people earning the minimum wage, in many cases, they don't necessarily belong to a household that is considered poor, for example, because the main reason, at least in Europe, it may be a little bit different in the United States, for example. Mm-hmm. The main reason in Europe for a household to be considered poor is not really low wages. It's more like the fact that many members of the household are out of employment, or like they don't work. So the link between improving a minimum wage and expecting that you're going to reduce poverty as a result is much weaker than what people may think.
Okay. So, but that situation would be improved greatly by the sort of relatively full employment that we have across Europe at the moment.
Yeah, you would expect, of course, as Christine said, that improving employment levels is going to have a very strong effect in reducing income inequality, probably much more than wage improvements.
Okay, good. So it's fact, it's seeing these two elements going hand in hand, in fact, as we move forward. But I suppose it also, this brings me nicely into the next question, which is really about, it's one thing to have minimum wage in place and that we have these requirements, whether it's, you know, collectively agreed or whether it's a national implementation. But what about compliance? You know, is there a compliance rate? And if there is, you know, how does that feed into the decision making around minimum wages?
Well, this is a topic, the topic of non-compliance. The first thing to say is that there's not a lot of data available on this issue. We just completed now a report at Eurofound where we tried to calculate it. The important thing to have in mind is that we don't get direct data on non-compliance provided from national institutions that deal with enforcement of minimum wage regulations, which is typically the labor inspectorates. It's hardly the case that countries gather this data and make it public.
You mean they gather the data, but they keep it?
Most countries don't even, not even
they
gather
don't even
the
gather
data.
It.
Yeah, it's hardly the case as well, because in most cases they cover this issue of minimum wage regulation together with a lot of labor law violations. So it's not so easy to get direct data on non-compliance with minimum wages. So the way we use to estimate this non-compliance, we do it indirectly. And directly, I mean, like, we use survey data. And then, of course, the people that is being interviewed in these surveys, they don't get asked straight away the question of whether are you receiving a wage which is below the minimum. So we have to use a statistical analysis by which we indirectly try to estimate it. So what we do is we know what's the minimum wage level in a certain country. Then, thanks to these surveys we have, we know more or less what's the wage a certain person is earning per month, and then we're able to compare both magnitudes, and then we see whether the weight of an employee is below or above or close to this minimum wage level. So then we can estimate in this way the whether, you know, somebody's below the minimum wage level in a certain country, and how far below, and we can estimate the rate of non-compliance.
But Carlos, if we're talking about, you know, that there's a directive on adequate minimum wages in place, and this is being implemented across at least, you know, 22 out of them in that way, and then otherwise in the other five, how is it possible that there isn't a requirement in parallel to have these kind of compliance figures available?
It's, I think that's in the directive. In fact, that's one of the areas where the directive, I think it's making the effort to, you know, to put out the message to European countries that there has to be an effort there to monitor compliance. So it's true, as I say, that it's a topic that perhaps has not received so much attention in the past. But I think with this minimum wage directive, that's perhaps starting to change a little bit. And it's, it's getting an impetus from the European Commission to, you know, to devote more importance to this policy area.
Because it also would provide an indicator of the success or otherwise of this rollout, in fact, but in terms of what you know and what you've seen from the data that you've been able to source and calculate, what are we talking about, do you think, in terms of an overall rate of non-compliance?
So if I will give you straight away the numbers, we have two main sources of data. So according to one of them, when we are talking the European Union as a whole, according to one of those sources, around less than 7% of employees will be in that situation of non-compliance. According to the second source that we have, will be much less than 2%, for example. So I think with this data, we can say, is, of course, it doesn't seem to be a widespread phenomenon, but doesn't mean it's not relevant, especially when we look at certain countries or certain sectors or certain population groups. So, for example,
and of course, it's relevant to those who are not receiving it.
Exactly. So, for example, if we look at country level data, you know, we find there are like some countries where seem to have above average rates of non-compliance in both data sources that we have. And, you know, for example, Hungary or Cyprus, Germany or Spain will mm-hmm. be there. Then we have other countries where, you know, it seems that they will be below average levels of mm-hmm. non-compliance, which will be the case of Belgium, Finland or Slovakia, for example. So, and then, you know, the rest of the countries, they may come a bit higher in one source, a bit lower in the other. I think it's important to emphasize that, you know, in these calculations, because as I told you, we have two main data sources and both have some limitations in the data and the way we can build these variables of wages and etc. I think it's good to take these numbers, not like a precise estimation mm-hmm. of non-compliance, mm-hmm. rather more like an approximation that, you know, may flag in some mm. cases that we may have a higher risk of non-compliance. So it should be taken more as an approximation.
And when you see those figures, and particularly if you're looking at those, for example, that have a higher than average rate of non-compliance, and you're saying in a country like Spain or Italy, I think was another one that you mentioned, there are we seeing far beyond the average, or are we still in a relatively good place?
The type of numbers, I don't recall them exactly now, but for example, I'm telling you for the US as a whole, according to one of the sources, it's 7, for mm-hmm. example. So in some countries, it may be around 10% or 11, 12 at the maximum. And when it's below, it can be like 3, 4%. In the other data set, as I told you, is around 2%.
Yeah.
It can go up to 6% in some countries, below 1 in the others, for example.
And in terms of what we're seeing as a kind of like a system or a particular issue that's prevalent in these countries that have higher rates of non-compliance or indeed lower rates of it. What are we seeing? Is it because of the kind of sectors that these people are working in? Is it that they're more service-oriented countries? You know, what are we seeing that could tell us a story that we could look to address the issue?
Yeah. So, for example, I don't think there's a single factor that may explain it. One thing we see, of course, is that in countries where you will have a lot of people, you know, not necessarily below minimum wage levels, but, you know, relatively clustered around minimum wage levels, mm. right? So it means countries where, you know, a relatively significant part of the population is receiving low wages in the country, because you have so many people there at the bottom of the wage distribution, you tend to see a higher rate of non-compliance, right? Because, for example, as well, what can happen in many cases is you may have like a lot of employees that are, you know, at the bottom of the wage distribution. And even in the cases where they may be receiving the adequate wage mm-hmm. level in terms of, you know, monthly mm. payment that, you know, complies with the legislation, what can happen as well in some cases is if they tend to work longer hours than stated in their contract, for example, they may end up being in a situation of non-compliance. Because, for example, the employer may be paying the right amount in terms of the monthly installment that they are due, but if they end up, working too many hours and they are not properly compensated by them, at the end, really, you have a case of non-compliance, even though it wouldn't look like, you know.
Okay. No, and that makes sense. I mean, are we, I suppose, is it too simple to say that what we're looking at is the services sector in terms of tourism, in terms of HoReCa, you know, hotel, restaurants, etc., accommodation, care services? Are these the places where we're going to see this level of non-compliance most seriously?
Yeah, in terms of the most affected groups by non-compliance, in both sources we have of data, the picture is quite consistent and quite clear. Mm. So as you say, like, which type of employees are we looking at when we talk about non-compliance? It's mainly, they tend to be younger people. They are more likely to be female than male. They strongly tend to be lower educated, you know, with lower levels of educational mm-hmm. attainment. And then in terms of work arrangements, they tend to be more on temporary contracts mm-hmm. and quite importantly as well in part-time. Work. And then in terms of sectors, as you said, first they tend to work in smaller companies. And then in terms of sectors, they will tend to be more like working in agriculture, construction. Mm-hmm. and some service sectors as those that you mentioned, like hospitality or retail, for example. So in the analysis, clearly you see the sectors and type of workers clearly overrepresented among those that suffer more potentially this case of non-compliance with minimum wage regulation.
And it's interesting what you say about it being also that the high representation of younger women particularly there. But I suppose that's down to their part-time occupation, is it? Their desire for finding part-time jobs on many occasions for reasons of childcare and other.
Yeah, not only, but of course that's going to be a big factor, because as I said, we clearly see that people that is under part-time employment, they tend to be, you know, they are much more likely to be in this group of non-compliance with minimum wage regulations. And one of the factors why that might happen, as I told you, is because, you know, it could be that they are receiving a wage, you know, that in theory is the one they should be getting, which is, you know, complying with regulation. But if, for example, your contract states that you have to work 20 hours per week, or per month, and then you end up working 25, for example, and you are not compensated for those extra 5 hours, then in case you are falling under non-compliance with minimum wage regulation.
And Carlos, have we done any work on whether we see a disproportionate number of migrant workers in this bracket?
Concretely, not in this analysis, but we know based on the literature on the topic that migrant workers as well are a group that will be vulnerable here. Especially, for example, I told you, like agriculture, constructions are sectors where maybe there's a higher risk. And we know those are sectors where, for example, there's a big influx of migrant workers, for example.
Okay. Yeah. And just, I mean, not to deviate or go down a particular rabbit hole on this, but to do with the new forms of work and platform work, for example, have we any information on where they fit into this?
We don't have concrete data in this study because it's hard to really capture, you know, with the data sets we have available for this type of study, it's hard to capture, you know, what you define as platform work, you know, concretely with the data we have. But, you know, as I told you, we know like people on short working schemes, you know, maybe more affected, like, you know, those working part-time or under temporary contracts. So we know, for example, platform workers may end up in those situations.
So we assume there's some...
So we could assume that's the case, even though I cannot guarantee with the data we have.
Yeah. But in terms of what we've heard then, I mean, there is an issue. It depends where you are, what country, but, you know, and okay, you might consider it not to be excessive, but we do need to address this and we need to ensure that there is better compliance with the minimum wage regulations. I mean, what can we do to ensure at national level indeed, but at also at European level? Is there something more that should be put in place?
Yeah. So I think the first thing, as I told you at the beginning, because there's not a lot of, or at least in the past, there was not a lot of policy emphasis on this. I think the first step is to give that push to this area, because the situation now we have is that normally the main institution dealing with enforcement is the labor inspectorates. That's the case in most European Union countries. And the situation you find in labor inspectorates dealing with minimum wage regulation is that they don't have a specific department or a specific team of people dealing exclusively with the topic of minimum wage regulation, right? It's covered together with a big range of other potential violations of labor law. So as a result of that, it doesn't receive a lot of attention perhaps as well. So that means as well, as I told you, that we don't have very good data and most countries don't even collect this data, right, about the infringement. So I think giving a push to this policy area will help to improve that. So, you know, what could be done will be, first of all, to improve, you know, like the capacity of labor inspectorates to cover this issue. So that would mean, of course, like making sure you have resources in terms of personnel and money, you know, like to conduct all the activities that are necessary to, you know, to improve compliance with minimum wage regulation. When we talk about the activities that are necessary for this task, we can distinguish like two legs in the table. One is what you call deterrence measures, which is mainly like inspections and penalties, mm-hmm. right? But you have other type of measures, you know, like are preventive. So that can mean like training to, mm-hmm. to employees, to employers, to social partners, for example, or campaigns of awareness raising, for example.
Yeah.
So all that needs resources. So that would be a first main point. Other things we can mention, for example, we find in this area, because there's this lack of data that I told you, that very few countries have conducted evaluations of mm-hmm. past interventions on this area, right? So it would be as well good to, you know, to be able to have information about evaluations done at the country
sure,
level,
yeah.
about interventions that have been successful in this area of monitoring and ensuring compliance.
So ensuring a sort of best practice availability
yes,
as well.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that, you know, they have data, you know, mm-hmm. of what's going on. So that would be good as well. And then you asked me as well about the role of Europe,
yeah.
for example, in here. So, for example, something we can say about this, that this topic of non-compliance, it's quite related as well to other topics, you know, like you mentioned yourself, like other topics of working conditions, for example, like bogus self-employment mm. or non-recorded overtime, you know. And then, for example, in some of these topics that are related to the issue of non-compliance, we see already that the European Union has taken action in the past. For example, in the case of abusive subcontracting, for example, mm-hmm. there was regulation from the European Union in the past that tries to limit the extent that you are allowed to subcontract activities,
okay.
right?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
because we see that, you know, excessive subcontracting is one way in which mm-hmm. this compliance can emerge, because, you know, you are trying to save cost mm-hmm. along the chain, you know, and then that, of course, brings a risk that some employers may try to cut the corners by reducing the cost of the workforce, for example.
Sure, yeah.
And
yeah.
non-compliance could emerge. Mm-hmm. So the European Union has done action on this in the past, or, for example, as well, related to the migrant workers that you mentioned
yeah.
before. As well, there was action of European Commission in the issue of working conditions among the posted workers, mm-hmm. which means, like, you know, making sure when a worker of the European Union is sent from his mm-hmm. country to make a service, you know, to conduct in a different country, it's done with the, you know, complying with the working conditions
in that country. Yeah.
So, you know, whether yeah. it's not, you know, not directly related to non-compliance, all these side mm. topics have
sure.
been dealt with the European Commission, for example, in the past. And
so there's a lot of related areas, in
yes.
fact, that perhaps are not immediately visible to the eye as
yes.
being related to this, but should be taken on board. And I suppose I was just thinking as you were talking there also about the essential workers. We talked so much about them during the pandemic and, you know, how critical they were to maintaining our societies and functioning. And we talked a lot about what needed to be done there. But it was also very much related to ensuring quality jobs, and that pay is just one aspect of that, of course. But I mean, it's a fundamental part of it. But then there's the related aspects within those jobs, which are also about work intensity or autonomy or et cetera. So I assume at a European level also to be focusing on this quality job aspect is also an important factor.
Yes. I mean, in practice, I think we tend to see always that all the different aspects of working conditions are quite related mm. To each other. So it's never only a matter of pay. Typically, when you improve as well pay, you tend to improve as well the other working conditions areas. So mm. You cannot look at one of them in isolation. They are quite related to each other.
Sure. And also related back also the issues of gender equality, which we've talked about before mm-hmm. also, which is related in there also. Yeah. I mean, coming through these different issues, I suppose we could go on, as Christine said earlier, for probably most of the day. There are so many dimensions to this particular topic. But if you had kind of a few moments in an elevator with a policymaker, I mean, we usually end up our podcasts asking you to talk to me in three. And really, it's to allow you to highlight what would be the main points that you would say should be addressed as priority to contribute to resolving the issues in this particular area, which is minimum wage.
Yeah, so first, I think we need to see that we get really a better understanding of who are the minimum wage workers, to what extent are they based in low-income households. Who among them are then really the vulnerable minimum wage workers, and to what extent can we help them with the minimum wage rates raises only, or is it more an issue of raising working hours, increasing other social policies, other social benefits? That's when looking at the workers' side. But then I think there's also a research gap where we should not lose sight of the companies, and especially the companies that are employing a large proportion of minimum wage workers. And we certainly should have a look at what these substantial raises that we see now, to what extent do they impact these companies? How do the companies cope with the increases? What are their reactions? That companies can do. Some are more beneficial to workers than others. There is certainly research available in several member states, but I think we clearly miss an EU-wide picture of that question.
Okay, Carlos?
And then, on the topic of non-compliance, perhaps more concretely, I think, as I said before as well, like just already just starting giving more policy importance to this area will be positive. And then very concretely, to assure that countries have effective enforcement systems, right? Which means that, they have a reliable monitoring and they have controls and field inspections, to detect possibly these violations of the minimum wage regulations. And then other area perhaps related to that as well is, to make sure that if a certain employee issues a complaint about an employer that is not, complying with the legislation, it's important to make sure that they are properly protected against adverse treatment, because in some European Union countries that seems to be a bit of an issue, so to make sure that they have the right to the redress and they are helped in this dispute resolution with the employer.
Okay, so basically we need to know who they are and who these minimum wage workers represent. We need to also think about the companies and the impact that it actually has on them, this rise in minimum wages. And we need to focus more on this area of compliance, but also the enforcement issues, carrot and stick you talked about earlier. And I think that's important. And to protect those who are maybe raising questions or queries and to support the whistleblower, if that's what we need to call them. So I think we've gone some way to addressing some of the issues here today, and thank you both for joining us. It's really been a fascinating discussion, and as you've both said, this is an issue that touches on so many other areas that Eurofound is also doing work on. And I would call on our listeners to draw down from our website on these issues, such as gender equality, for example, on sustainable work, on job quality, on essential workers, on indeed companies and European companies, but so much more that we've talked about today. And of course, please do read our most recent Minimum Wages in 2023 annual review and the Minimum Wages Non-Compliance and Enforcement Across EU Member States, which are available to download on the Eurofound website. So thank you again to my guests, and also, of course, thank you to our listeners. And until next time, when Eurofound talks to you.
Good jobs, quality jobs.
We still have so much to do for women's rights.
For the parents to go to work, you need good childcare.
We will not have a successful recovery if we leave social rights.
Reinventing our way of building and living.
It is our right.